What's up, hockey players? Welcome to the Jesus and Movies podcast, where we search movies for lines, scenes, characters, and themes that trace truth and the gospel. I'm Kevin Carlock. I'm here with my fellow American, Graham Hooten, and our hope is that you'll join us on the great journey of storytelling by asking thoughtful questions about why certain movies and moments resonate or don't resonate, and what that might say about the movie, about you, and perhaps about humanity as a whole. Today we're talking about Miracle, and Graham, my one question for you is, who do you play for?
I play for the United States of America.
Let's go, Kev. Happy Winter Olympic season. We're kicking off the 2022 Olympics coming up in Beijing next week. And what a great time to revisit the greatest hockey movie of all time and one of the greatest sports movies of all time. I'm so pumped for this.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I don't know like anything about hockey.
Yeah, not a huge hockey guy myself. Watched my fair share of Chicago Blackhawks playoff games growing up, but the director chose to go out and, instead of cast actors, cast hockey players and teach them how to act. And I think it really pays off in this film.
Let's talk a little bit about the music. As you know, my favorite thing to do in the opening.
Love the opening scenes as we're going through the news clips. You've got a little bit of the snare drum, very militaristic march. I think this movie is inherently a patriotic movie, and so the score plays that up really well.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The secret behind today's modern computer is the silicon chip. Some experts predict this modern marvel might one day impact our daily lives.
This is homecoming day for Apollo 17, the last round trip to the moon that Americans may take.
You know, that opening montage is sneaky long. Like, it is, it's at least 3 minutes. It's all of 3 minutes of it is. I remember thinking, like, wow, like, so many news clips, voiceovers, like, they really want us to, like, understand the world that we're going into before we start to care about Herb Brooks and this hockey team.
I guess when I think of important moments at the score, I think as the buzzer sounds at the end of the third period of the USSR game.
McClanahan is there. The puck is still loose. 11 seconds. You got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Tomorrow. Up to 5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
I love how it gets a little bit more subtle, especially as Brooks is in the tunnel after the game. That's one of my favorite scenes of this movie, is just the fist pump. Yes! Yes! It breaks down crying.
Talk about Moneyball parallels. That's like very similar to Brad Pitt. You know, he does that little like tiger, he steps into it, whereas Mark is more of a two-hander Phil Mickelson over the head.
I'm glad we're able to differentiate between these celebrations.
One thing I also want to talk about, Graham, is the Russians and how there's sort of this cool tension in the movie of like, do you play out of love or do you play out of fear? And we sort of see that at the end, right? When like the U.S. wins and Herb like gives an affirming nod to the other coach. And you can like see in the Russian coach's eyes that like, oh my gosh, like maybe it's okay that I lost. Like, maybe this is...
Even seeing the coaching style, like, the Russian goalkeeper should never have been pulled. It's one of the crazier, I guess, notes about the actual game of the Miracle on Ice is that I don't know if the United States wins if they leave the best goalkeeper in the world in the net, and yet he makes this decision out of fear because he doesn't pull the goalie at the end because he doesn't know what to do, right? He doesn't know how to troubleshoot when things go wrong.
Yeah, maybe this kind of transitions us into a larger conversation about nationalism.
It's very black and white. This movie doesn't really grapple with, I think, intense ideas of nationalism. It feels a lot more like a sports movie than it does feel like a geopolitical conflict. I mean, I know we get the Carter speech and we got...
Yeah, but I don't think it should. Yeah. Like, I think this movie nails it. Do you think that it's missing the nuance? Like, you want more?
I don't think so. I mean, I think this is a sports movie through and through.
Yeah, I agree. It's helpful to think about these stories as like, if this were pure fiction, how would it be written? Yes. And I think like setting up this is like the stakes between the US and Russia. And we're basically, not only are we like building the world in which the story is going to take place, but we're also sneaky building the character arc for Herb, which is this is more than just a hockey game.
Yeah.
Like, that is the central question of his character arc, is like, will he learn that this is bigger than him? And it's not a huge arc. Like, I wouldn't say the movie is fundamentally about him changing as much as it is, will the team succeed? It's more about want than need, to use writer speak. I think that's in like a totally fiction setting. Like, that's why that intro montage exists. Like,
totally. And it's interesting, right? Because we can't even fully appreciate, I don't think, you and me, as people who are born post-Cold War, the intensity of the conflict between Americans and Russians during this time. And really, this is about young men and a coach who's willing to believe when nobody else is.
Yeah, that's totally what the movie's about. And just to kind of take you into Kev's writing corner for a moment, it's a classic three-act story, right? And the first act is basically, will Herb Brooks create a team for this goal of the Winter Olympics? And like, the inciting incident would be he gets the call saying he's going to get the job. And yes, he like formulates his roster, but he hasn't really finished the tension of Act One and picked that team until we have Mike Ruzioni declare that he plays for the United States of America. And that is going to be the turning point, which sends us into Act Two, which is, will this team come together and be like, a team that can compete with the best in the world, with the Soviets eventually? But like, will they overcome their squabbles and will they get good enough? And then the last act is, will they win the Olympics? It's basically like, once we arrive there. So you have a clear hero, Herb Brooks, the coach. You have a clear goal, beat the Soviets, win the gold medal. And it's really just like a simple structure, but I think it works really, really well. Each act kind of propels you gently and organically into the next one, and we can follow along. And I love how the stakes just kind of slowly and seemingly linearly escalate. Mm-hmm. So like, Herb is encountering pressure not only from outside forces like the Russians and the media and the board of amateur hockey directors who have different views of what the team should be, more like Moneyball type conflicts. But then you also have those internal squabbles, like we've seen, Remember the Titans, right? Players getting along together. Are they going to run the system? Are we going to have good chemistry? Are we going to like commit to this process and this new strategy that seems a little bit outlandish? So maybe you're already hearing some parallels with the other sports movies we've done.
Yeah, now that you bring it up, there are a lot of parallels to a movie like Remember the Titans. Again, it's another Disney sports film, but very coach-centric, conflict, coach grafts the team together, achieving great things, you know, internal conflict. I think of Gary's car accident and Remember the Titans. You can, a little bit less dramatic, but O'Callaghan's injury and how that affects the team. And so you got these individual things going on as well. So, yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a formula that works. I mean, this movie works for me. And really, at times, it's quite emotional to watch. I don't know about for you.
Yeah, I think it's the most emotional of those three movies. I mean, I was sobbing as I watched this. And then I had to watch it twice because I thought it was so good. I think the ending is so moving. And
of course,
so many award options in this movie.
Oh my gosh. We are swimming in a sea of awards. We get a lot of sweeping statements about what it means to be a part of a team, what it means to be an individual, what it means to serve and lead, and just a lot to pull from. Absolute gold mine.
Alrighty then, give me your Lazarus Award for the high-key gospel moment of miracle.
I'm giving my Lazarus Award to the Mike Ruzioni, I play for the United States of America scene.
Come on, Craig, blow the whistle. Again.
Mike Ruzioni! With through Massachusetts.
Who do you play for?
I play for the United States of America.
That's all, gentlemen.
And this is my pulpit pick. I think this scene marks a watershed moment, specifically in the team's shift from individualism to collectivism, right? All these players arrive to Colorado Springs training to be a part of the United States hockey team as individuals, right? They're Mike Arizioni from Boston College and Jack O'Callaghan from Minnesota or wherever any of these players are from. When we think about buzzwords that describe American ideals, we get words like liberty and freedom and self-expression and capitalism. Again, very individualistic words. Do what makes you happy. Fight for what you deserve and what you can own for yourself. You know I'm a big NBA fan, Kev, and one of my favorite NBA talking heads is Bill Simmons, who runs this company called The Ringer. And Bill Simmons talks a lot about the NBA and calls this specific era of the league the player empowerment era. And he marks the start of that era with LeBron's The Decision in 2010. I don't know if you remember this. Back in 2010, LeBron is in Cleveland. He hosts this nationally televised special on ESPN and says, I'm taking my talents to South Beach to go play for the Miami Heat with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. Ends up winning a couple championships. And Simmons says that this is marking the end of an era because gone are the days of one-team superstars. Again, think of Larry Bird with the Celtics, Magic Johnson with the Lakers, Michael Jordan with the Bulls. We're not going to talk about those Wizards years. Tim Duncan with the Spurs, Kobe Bryant with the Lakers. It doesn't matter your loyalties to your team. You can actually tank your franchise into doing what's best for you. Again, think about what James Harden did with the Houston Rockets these past couple of years. Anthony Davis tanks his way out of New Orleans to go get to LA to play with LeBron. Kyrie Irving throws a fit in Boston, and the one and only Ben Simmons in Philadelphia, who's holding out this entire year with hopes of getting traded, even though he's sacrificing millions of dollars and hurting his team, who actually has a legitimate chance of the championship because Joel Embiid is playing like an MVP this year. Again, sorry, maybe these are heady things for you if you're not a basketball fan, but it's not just basketball. We live in an age where name, image, and likeness is the new buzz phrase in college athletics, where Cristiano Ronaldo, soccer superstar, has more followers than there are people in the United States of America. Tom Brady is making more money from his branding deals than he is off of actually playing professional football. And is any of this inherently wrong? Maybe not. But what it demonstrates is that it's harder than ever to build a collective team identity when everybody is screaming me, me, me. And so Herb's message from the very beginning is about reshaping identity. Players are challenged to check their talent, their egos, their reputations at the door. It doesn't matter who's won a national championship, who's the leading goal scorer in the NCAA, or who's gotten a shot at the NHL, but rather, who's willing to buy into a team-first mentality. Again, Herb says to the guys in the Olympic Committee, he's not looking for the best players, he's looking for the right ones.
You're missing some of the best players.
Looking for the best players, Craig. I'm looking for the right ones.
And so what does this say about what he values? Maybe about what God values. And so I love this Arizioni surrender moment because it really is that. It's a moment of surrender. At his wit's end, unable to grasp the thought of doing one more skate down the ice, he declares that he is no longer just a hockey player, but a team member of the United States of America. His identity is no longer rooted in himself, but in the team that he is a part of. And so I think this directly parallels what it looks like to follow Jesus. Jesus leads the disciples and all followers of him in a missional community. Again, they are a group of people who are pursuing something greater than themselves with the people that they love. And just think about how Jesus teaches his followers to pray. Our Father who art in heaven. It's not my Father who art in heaven. It's 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 through 10. It says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." I especially love verse 10 there. Once you were not a people, but now you are a people of God. And if that's not what Herb Brooks is doing here, I don't know what he's doing. Again, this group of guys, they're a group of individuals. They're people who are talented, who are bringing their own stories and backgrounds and baggage to this team. They're old beefs and rivalries and scores to settle between players. And yet Herb crafts them into a people with a unified identity. And that's one of the things that makes that final scene when they're all standing on the podium so powerful. It's a couple of guys who didn't know each other, who didn't care about one another, who are willing to sacrifice everything for one another. And so they're a family, as O'Callaghan says later in the film. They have been chosen by Herb, that they may live into their identity as American hockey players, bring glory to their country, and mercifully love one another. And so that's why, for me, that I play for the United States of America scene wins my Lazarus Award.
What do we make of Herb if he is the one who's kind of choosing these people to be a part of his community and, in theory, running with your award? Like, he's kind of the god figure that is, like, building this community, right? Mm-hmm. Or, like, it's made in his likeness, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Is there some kind of parallel to be drawn here with, like, even when God, like, enables, allows, causes suffering in our lives, like, is he up to something? Is he trustworthy? Like, how much can we take Herb to be a Jesus figure in this moment?
Maybe there's something to be said for the fact that Herb has a reason for everything he does. I think that's one of the things that the trainer says.
So tell me something. Does he always treat his players like this?
No. No, no, this I have never seen. But, no, but Craig, believe me, Herb has a reason for everything he does.
And so I think maybe that little nugget at the beginning makes him a little bit more of a trustworthy figure for me. I don't know. It's hard not to be shaded by the end of the film.
Yeah, maybe the reason I don't have much of a bone to pick with your Lazarus Award and wanted to explore the context of it with Coach Herb is because I have the same Lazarus Award.
Oh.
Michael Muzioni, Winthrop, Massachusetts. I play for the United States of America. For me, the reason this moment is so powerful is because Mike Muzioni feels a lot like Jesus. Jesus says, enough is enough. I'll lay down my pride so that my teammates can walk free. And when I try to think about, like, what really is going on there within that parallel specifically, I think it's three things. One, it's the humility to get vulnerable. He's going to lay his identity down, you know, publicly in a way that the other teammates have not yet. And so he's going to be seen as maybe soft or weird for doing so. Two, he does so to save those that he loves. He's doing it in the interest of his teammates. And three, in doing so, and this was your point, he starts a true community. So you focused on three, so maybe I'll move some of my emphasis to one and two. I couldn't help but think about National Treasure 2, an iconic scene. Before the Civil War, the states were all separate. People used to say, the United States are. It wasn't until the war ended that people started to say, the United States is. Under Lincoln, we became one nation. And Lincoln paid for it with his life. So did Thomas Gates. Right? With his life. So how am I going to get him alone? I'm going to kidnap him. I'm going to kidnap the President of the United States. And that is an epic teaser for what is an epic movie. But seriously, I think that this scene is basically the same thing, right? It's Minnesota and Boston and UNH becoming the USA. And you know what's so great about the gospel, Graham? Jesus doesn't call out his own name on the cross. Jesus, son of Joseph, Nazareth in Galilee. Yeah. No, he cries out to his father. Matthew 27:46, and about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice saying, Eli, Eli, lima sabachthani, that is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And the reason Jesus is stuck there with rusty nails and his cut open wrists crying out to his father is so that he can cry out our names on the cross. Kevin Carlock, Greensboro, North Carolina, you will be with me in my kingdom forever. Graham Hooten, Chicago, Illinois, you will be with me in my kingdom forever. And so that's the great distinction between what Mike Ruzioni is doing and what Jesus is doing, is Mike is calling out his own name, saying, this is who I am. And Jesus is saying, Father, I am one with you. This is what I'm about. But he's also crying out our names on the cross. He's doing it to save us. And so I think the salvation element is stronger, of course, in the gospel than it is in this scene here.
Man, yeah. Again, I can't disagree with much because I chose the same Lazarus Award, but what does that say, too, about servant leadership? Ruzioni is the one who goes on to become the captain, and he is first in line to surrender. The Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many.
Yeah, and I think to your point about kind of the player empowerment era, like, that kind of notion of a team captain seems a little bit dead or dying. I don't know.
Yeah, and again, I think I'm... This is a bigger conversation. I'm for NIL and just what that's doing to college sports and allowing, you know, athletes to profit off of their name, image, and likeness. But I worry about losing that true inherent nature of sports. That's about sacrifice. That's about team first mentality. And I think that's one of the things that makes this movie so great. Is that it's a bunch of college kids, you know, now that they started making dream teams, as Herb says in the end. People seldom get the chance to dream, and I just think there's something that feels so pure about the athletics here.
No, I agree. Take me to your Mary Magdalene Award for a low-key gospel moment in Miracle.
My Mary Magdalene Award goes to just a tiny little line that Herb tells his boys, be prepared to grow through pain.
I can't promise you We'll be the best team at Lake Placid next February.
But we will be the best conditioned team. That I can promise you.
Be prepared to grow through pain, gentlemen.
We see how Herb uses suffering, actually collective suffering, is one of the main ways to graft this team into a community. They are suffering alongside one another in the suicides. I think of the scenes where they're doing the L squats against the walls, passing the weights back and forth, the ridiculous tests that they have to take with questions that seemingly are no nonsense. But suffering, I think, is instrumental in the development of any community. And I actually think it's one of the most underlooked doctrines of the Christian faith. In Western culture, suffering is very taboo, or at the very least, very disdained. Again, people don't like to suffer. We talk about taking drugs or, seeking counsel so we can alleviate the suffering in our life. And yet Christianity, in many ways, seems to thrive under suffering, right? I'm thinking about the early church, specifically in the Roman context, where it was illegal to be a Christian, and you've gotten people who are being martyred left and right every single day. I think about Stephen, the first martyr, and I believe that's Acts 9. He's killed for speaking out in the gospel. I think about how Paul is constantly in prison. You know, his letters, the majority of the New Testament, takes place as Paul is experiencing great persecution. Again, writing his prison epistles from places like Philippi and other churches he has planted or visited. And then Jesus talks about this in Matthew 16:24, saying, if any of you is to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And I think I've referenced this in the past, but when we look to places in the world where the church is thriving, oftentimes it's in these little corners of Africa, or even in the Middle East, or in China, where Christianity is actually illegal. And again, this pushes people out of the lukewarm center that is so common, especially in the American South, where cultural Christianity becomes a thing. And might I even make the argument that cultural Christianity is inherently bad for the greater body of Christ, where this becomes an identifying marker as opposed to a life that is truly lived in submission to Jesus Christ and the teachings he has. And so the main verse I wanted to focus on here is Romans 5:3, which says, "Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope." I think my main critique would be that Herb doesn't seem to suffer himself in that process, whereas Jesus, being the head of the church, is sufferer-in-chief, maybe SEO as opposed to CEO. Identifying spiritual warfare and embracing that suffering, I think there's a deep fellowship that comes with Christ, where I can see eye to eye, where I can understand just the slightest bit how he felt to be shunned, to be not accepted, and to be persecuted for living the life that his father asked of him. And so that's why Be Prepared to Go Through Pain wins my Mary Magdalene Award.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, that's something that I wanted to talk about in this movie, is like, how much can we trust Herb as the captain of this ship? Like, I guess I'm a little bit uncomfortable concluding that like all, you know, suffering in our lives has this kind of one-to-one ratio with like where we're headed. Like, you know, it's one thing for these players to know that we're going to be running all these suicides and we're going to be bleeding and we're going to be tired and we're not going to get to do the social things we wanted to do because we're working towards this clear goal of trying to win the 1980 Olympics. And so there's like a clear purpose throughout. Whereas I think sometimes in our lives, it's sort of like, why do I need to be suffering in this way? What purpose could there possibly be? Does God use every scrap for his good and his glory and for our sanctification? Or is it just kind of, this is a reality of being human and it doesn't have to do with God's purposes?
That's tough. I mean, I feel like there's scriptural arguments for both, because you think of Romans 8:28, like, for all things, God works for the good of those who love him. But then you also look at a book like Job and you're like, Job, again, we talked about implementing a Job award to the podcast for the character who gets unnecessarily shafted by the film. Again, I think part of it is taking this posture of humility, that we have too narrow a mindset to understand and believe that God is working in and around us. And so in a weird way, I don't know if we even have the right to judge that. I feel like that's what the book of Job concludes. All right, Kev, take me to your Mary Magdalene Award.
I'm giving my Mary Magdalene Award to the team demanding that Herb give a speech at the Christmas party.
Oh, surprise pick here.
Yeah, it's kind of a small move. I mean, Graham and I talked briefly before this, even though we didn't spoil each other's awards, but there's so many Mary Magdalenes to choose from. I mean, like, every scene has multiple Mary Magdalenes, it seems like.
Yep.
But the reason I picked this one is because I think there's a compelling idea here about earning the right to be heard. These guys are just thirsting to hear Herb talk about something bigger picture, I feel like, in this scene. They have that kind of moment where they're about, you know, about to leave, and they're just looking to him intently.
Well, this may come as a shock to some of you guys, but I'm not really very good at giving sentimental speeches.
No. I don't think I should start tonight, so.
Hey, thanks for having me over, Velpa.
Good night, Herb.
Dot, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Herb.
You guys have a great holiday.
And this is my pulpit pick. I kind of feel like everybody wants to shout their own opinions, whether it's through, you know, social media or diverting conversations back to you and your interests in person, or by having your own blog or your website or your podcast. And I think that's something that Graham and I have wrestled with. Like, why are we actually doing this? Are we really trying to funnel people to a local church and get people excited about the gospel, share truth? Or is it kind of like sneaky about us and like, you know, making us seem competent and like Christians who are all in or whatever? But anyways, I think as Christians, like, we want to be men and women naturally in a listening and a learning posture, men and women who treat others decently and live our lives in such a distinct and attractive way that other people are just thirsting to know what we think about things. We want to build real relational credibility by caring for people and proving that we value them and that we can be trusted. And I think that's what I see with Herb and this team here. Like, they want to hear him speak because he's committed to making this hockey team as good as it can possibly be, and they respect his drive. Even if it means dead legs and blistered hands, Herb has earned the right to be heard with this group. And so this is Proverbs 17. It's just kind of more of a practical side, less God's promise, that gets at some of these ideas. Verses 27, 28. Whoever restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool who keeps silent is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is deemed intelligent. So that's just kind of practical wisdom there about, like, you know, being slow to speak and quick to listen makes you seem wise and naturally lends to your credibility. And being slow to speak and quick to listen comes from James 1 here, verse 19. Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. And so those are kind of like the principles of it, but maybe, you know, as is most things, a story resonates a little more deeply. So I've got John 1, Jesus calling the first disciples. You know, you have to kind of fill in the blanks a little bit. I'll admit I'm stretching it. You as a listener should call me out and push back. See if you think this is really in here or not. But I think Jesus earns the right to be heard with these disciples when he first meets them. So this is verse 35. The next day, again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples with John heard John say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" Jesus said to them, "Come and you will see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And so what we see here is, like, Nathanael figures out that Jesus is the Son of God when he's, like, been shown that, like, Jesus has this extra knowledge, that how else could he have known that? Like, Jesus has earned the right to be heard. At that point, Nathanael's all ears. And I think that's the case with the first two disciples. And, you know, Jesus spends time with them fishing. "I'll make you fishers of men," we get in one of the other gospel accounts, right? It's kind of hard for us to conceptualize this, because when we think about Jesus in the gospels, we think about him preaching everywhere he goes, and he's telling parables, and he's always, you know, speaking in the red font in our Bibles. And so we think of him as someone who is, like, in the communicative seat all the time. Like, if he were here, he'd have his podcast. He'd be the big speaker at the big conference. But I don't know. Like, Graham and I, we've talked about how Jesus' 3-mile-an-hour ministry doesn't start until he's 30 years old. And I just have to imagine there's so much going on between the lines in these gospel accounts. I think Jesus really does earn the right to be heard. I think about how he sits patiently with the woman at the well and the Samaritan. And really, like, I just think about my own experience as a Christian. Specifically, I want to hone in on RUF at Davidson. Like, I didn't really care that much about what my campus minister preached in large group until he really, like, won me over in the one-on-one settings. Mm-hmm. And it almost feels embarrassing to admit that I wasn't super attentive in those, like, youth group, almost like church-like large group settings. But when he was able to pull details from my life and from conversations over a year ago in one-on-one conversations over a ham sandwich and make them meaningful and relevant, it was like mind-blowing to me. And that's when I was like, oh my gosh, this guy really cares about me. Maybe he actually has something meaningful to say. Like, he's proven himself. He's shown his stripes in the one-on-one. Mm. That made me like reevaluate the way that I was listening to him preach through the Bible. So, you know, maybe that's too autobiographical or too much info, but I think that earning the right to be heard, there's kind of a spectrum. If that's on one side, the other side would be like, no, relentless love, like, gives people even what they don't want in the moment. If someone's standing on a highway and a truck's about to hit them, the Christ-like thing to do is to save them, to dive in after them, even though they didn't want it. I think we could all maybe stand to go a little bit towards the former, which is respecting other human beings' thoughts and their agency a little bit more.
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. I mean, what do you feel like Herb really does to earn the right to be heard with his players? Obviously, he's pushing them super hard, but where do you see him really living that out in maybe a humble, Christ-like way?
I think it's just his intensity and his drive. And, like, he has a mission with this team. The second that, you know, the team names are announced, he's standing at the back and he says, "Take a good look, gentlemen, because those are the ones getting off easy." And you just know that it's going to be a grind from there to the finish. And I think those elite competitors and athletes, they want that. Even though the coach is sort of, in a weird way, set up as their enemy, ultimately, the stronger your enemy, like, the more you get towards what you're working for.
Interesting. So I wonder, like, do you feel like, and I know you didn't choose him to be your Jesus Award figure, but is this more indicative of God the Father than a Jesus character? I guess, is there something to be said for the fact that he is more of an authoritarian figure as opposed to a side-by-side, you know, I'll be your friend and be your shoulder to cry on character?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, he sort of sets up the good cop, bad cop with assistant coach Craig, right? He's totally. Like, basically, I'm going to be the whip and Craig is going to be your golden retriever that you can talk to when you're down.
I'll be your coach. I won't be your friend. If you need one of those, take it up with Doc or Coach Patrick.
I guess Jesus is in some ways like the total combination, the duality of those two together, and maybe even more of the golden retriever than the whip. I don't know. But yeah, I just think, to answer your question, like, Herb hasn't won them over through his outstanding personal interactions with them. I don't think he's particularly winsome. I think he just is committed to this goal and they respect that. Even in college, like, I think if you are someone who says, you know what, I'm a Christian and I'm not going to do underage drinking and I'm not going to sleep around, even if people are wildly disagreeing with that and think, you idiot, like, you're missing out on everything, I think they can respect a basic commitment to conviction that they sort of wish that they had or do have in their lives in other areas.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like, I respect someone who thinks differently from me but is, like, totally bought into it. I'm like, you know what? That person, like, wants something and they're chasing it.
Yeah.
And, like, I think we can all admire that. I think it's why we root for characters like Herb.
No, I'm with you. Good stuff. Thanks for the explanation.
Alrighty, take me to your false prophet award for a non-biblical argument in Miracle.
My false prophet award goes to the scene where Herb sends Timmy Haar home when he can help the United States team.
We just wanted to be fair, Herb.
He even tried telling me that. He was right there in Colorado.
That was 6 months ago.
Well, you don't think he's been playing for the last 6 months?
No, with us he hasn't.
So?
So there's a difference.
Like hell there is. All I know is that kid can flat out play.
What, and we can't?
Yeah, he moves the puck. He's got great vision on the ice. Stick, soft hands.
That's stick. Not the point.
I'll tell you something else he's got. He's got the attitude I want on and off the ice. So somebody here better explain to me why I shouldn't be giving him a hell of a look.
Because we're a family. We're a family.
Family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the family that you want to go to Lake Placid with.
Definitely.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Absolutely. Wouldn't have any other way.
Timmy here can help us, boys. And I'm going to send him home.
So when we talk about the False Prophet Award, we talk about a non-biblical argument that the movie makes. And I think we're led to believe that this is a super triumphant scene, right? Like, we're family, you know, loyalty, that's what we're all about. But what if he actually can help the team? The passage that immediately came to mind is a classic. It's the prodigal son. This is Luke 15, 25 through 32. Again, the younger son has just come home to the father. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near to the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has had him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered to his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we've had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." I think there's a little bit of a critique here in that this is a unique situation where there are 20 spots and not everybody can join. But I do think the kingdom looks like being excited that other people are joining our team. And that's why this wins my False Prophet Award.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I almost picked this moment for my Mary Magdalene, but I didn't because I thought you would pick it for your Mary Magdalene. So here I am just flabbergasted that you picked it for your False Prophet.
Oh, yeah.
Because I thought you would say this is like what it means to lock arms as the local church, like when he says, "This is a family." I thought that was such a potent moment. And so this is kind of one of where we have taken the parallel to Christianity,
right?
Even though it's not in the movie, and then we're critiquing, like, if this was the gospel, here's where it would be off.
Right. If we are taking this parallel and applying it to the church, this is why the church is different than what most of the world looks like. This is what the church offers that a hockey team could never, because there is inherent exclusivity.
Cox doesn't have to go home.
Oh, poor Ralph Cox. He's a clear Job Award winner.
That's tough. He was so likable. It was so hard to watch. I mean, that scene was heartbreaking.
Yeah, you're a great hockey player. Yeah. Yeah. Poor guy. All right, Kev, take me to your False Prophet Award.
My False Prophet Award goes to Herb's line during the again suicides where he says, "This cannot be a team of common men because common men go nowhere. You have to be uncommon."
This cannot be a team of common men, because common men go nowhere. You have to be uncommon. Again.
I'm all for ambition and discipline. Seriously, just ask Graham. And I totally agree that this is how this hockey team, and really any serious sports team, can and should be coached. And I think of myself as an uncommon writer, outworking most of the others. And I think that there's biblical rationale to support this kind of attitude. We have verses like Romans 12:2, like, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what the will of God is, what's good and acceptable and perfect." AKA, be a little different, be distinct. Like, this life is going to change you. And perhaps you've heard this one beat over your head over the years. Colossians 3:23, "Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men." And so sometimes I think that's applied out of context, but there are these real reasons for biblically motivated work ethic, right? But I think if we're not careful, we can walk away from this movie with a few false ideas here. One, results determine worth. Two, results trump process. Three, results trump motive. And to counter, the Christian receives his or her worth directly from God's promises about who we are. And we then ask, how and why does God want me to pursue this job, this friend, this spouse, this trophy? And though the movie certainly isn't arguing against this, ultimately the gospel is kind of only for the common man. It's those who think that they're uncommon and above the good news of Jesus that actually end up in hell. And just look at how Jesus chooses people throughout the Bible. I mean, King David is the most famous character in the Old Testament. He's the most quoted character in the New Testament. His selection in 1 Samuel 16:11 comes in such a stunning you could say straw in a manger type situation. Verse 11, then Samuel said to Jesse, are all your sons here? Samuel said, there remains yet the youngest, but behold, he's keeping the sheep. His father, Jesse, had written off David as like this, you know, not an insignificant human, but he's a shepherd. He's an insignificant selection to be this anointed king of Israel. Luke 1, we get kind of a similar idea with Mary, right? This is the Christmas story, verses 34 to 35. And Mary said to the angel, how will this be since I'm a virgin? AKA, why pick me? And the angel said to her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child will be born and will be called Holy, the Son of God. And I think what we see, whether it's David or Mary, or whether it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, or in the New Testament, God does supernatural things through very ordinary and undeserving people. There's a couple things that are kind of, we miss this. One is I think sometimes we turn Christianity into this like disciplined Navy SEAL life of reading the Bible, praying, going to church, tithing and serving. And we kind of create this distinction between like us as the real Christian and everyone else who just goes to church a couple times a year or has John 3:16 in their Instagram bio. And we think that because we're doing all these things, God loves us more or worse, that like we'll be blessed, that God will like reward us. And all the while, Christianity has become more about us than about God and who he is. And so we get it all backwards again. I want to read this quote from Eugene Peterson from The Contemplative Pastor.
Love that.
He's talking about pastoring here, but I think it applies to all of us as we're called to do ministry and share the gospel with others. Pastoral work is that aspect of Christian ministry that specializes in the ordinary. It's the nature of pastoral life to be attentive to, immersed in, and appreciative of the everyday texture of people's lives, the buying and selling, the visiting and meeting, the coming and going. Most people most of the time are not in crisis. If pastoral work is to represent the gospel and develop a life of faith in the actual circumstances of life, it must learn to be at home in what novelist William Golding has termed the ordinary universe, the everyday things in people's lives. Yes, being uncommon helps you win, and we should absolutely strive to be uncommon people. But the gospel is all about common people doing mundane things in ordinary places and times. So while Herb Brooks says common men go nowhere, Jesus says common men who believe in me go to heaven.
Man, I love that, because what does that do? That makes the gospel so much more accessible. Even though we are called to believe, right? It's not about the strength of our belief, but the fact that we believe. I know you talk about this idea of the ladder analogy, right? Where it's not about how much you believe in the ladder that you're standing on, rather the fact that you are standing on the ladder. And so I think that's really freeing, even for people who are wrestling with doubts and who want to follow Jesus but aren't sure about X, Y, and Z major principle issue going forward. Like, I think we're not called to have all the answers. I think we're called to put our faith in Jesus, who is the author and perfecter of our faith. That's why Jesus's gospel is so appealing to the marginalized, the poor, the lost, the widows, the prostitutes. Again, this is not a gospel that is for the high and mighty and taughty. Again, I think one of the things that is underscored throughout the Gospels is that some of the main character issues with the Pharisees and the religious leaders is this idea of self-righteousness, that they don't need to be saved. And I think Jesus asks people to, one, know that they need to be saved, and two, choose to trust in him that he's going to do everything to accomplish that salvation. So again, I think there's a lot to be affirmed in that as common men.
Yeah, the ladder metaphor is great. I actually heard a new one at this men's study at my church lately. It's about walking on ice. Basically, like, it's not about how you walk across the frozen lake. It's about like how thick the ice is. And there's kind of layers to it. I don't totally understand it, but I just always assume that these structured Presbyterians like have picked their metaphors like in an intentional manner. And so part of me thinks that the walking on the ice one is probably better than the ladder, because we're not really climbing to heaven in our, but anyways, yeah, they're both great. And that's the idea, right? Is that like at the end of the day, it's not about your work ethic. It's about, did God do this or not? Similar to the fact that everyone in our generation kind of wants to ask the question of like, why should I want Christianity? Which is a great question. And as believers, we need to be able to make it attractive and show why this is everything. But really the question at the end of the day should be, did Jesus really die on a cross and resurrect or not? Like, is this historical? Is this true? Like, is this true should be more important than like, should I want it? Fortunately, we don't have to pick between the two because it's both. But anyways, take me to your Jesus Award for the most Christ-like figure in Miracle.
My Jesus Award goes to Herb. Heb, as some of the guys would say.
Heb.
Heb. One, he chooses his team slash his people according to his desire, not their merit. Again, think about the process of how he picks the team.
Those kids haven't been on the ice for what? Maybe a couple of hours.
Walter, every one of those boys was chosen for a specific reason. I've studied film on each and every one of those boys. I've seen them, I've watched them, and I've coached a lot of them. And the ones I haven't, I've spoken with our coaches and scouts in the area. Now, I know best what I need to compete, and the team I've chosen is it.
I think of Ephesians 1:4, for he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. Perhaps a little doctrine of election there for you, Kev. Mm. A little Calvinism, a little Reformed theology, just throwing that out there. Herb also coaches his team into a new way to play, in the way that Jesus teaches us a new way to live.
Johnson! That coast-to-coast stuff may work here, but it won't against the teams we'll be playing.
Think about all the times in the Gospels where Jesus says, "You have been told, but I tell you." Again, the world says this, I say that. Herb reminds the team that old rivalries have no place here. I think about the fight between McClanahan and O'Callaghan.
Oh!
That's it.
Well, how about it, boys? Look like hockey to you? It's more like a couple of monkeys trying to hump a football to me. I don't know. What do you think, Craig?
Yeah.
You want to settle old scores, you're on the wrong team. We move forward starting right now. We start becoming a team right now.
I almost picked that for a Mary Magdalene Award.
I love that scene because he's teaching the guys how to live out of mercy, out of this new identity. And so I picked, you know, Philippians 2:3, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, rather in humility, value others above yourselves. He's teaching them that old rivalries have no place here. We are on the same team. We treat each other the way that we want to be treated here. And he tells his team that they will grow through pain and suffering. Again, Romans 5:3, this is a more of a Paul line that I referenced earlier. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces endurance. He plays defense by playing offense. This is actually a really interesting principle.
But I also know there is a way to stay with this team. You don't defend them. You attack them. You take their game and you shove it right back in their face. The team that is finally willing to do this is the team that has a chance to put them down. NHL won't change their game, we will. The rest of the world is afraid of them. Boys, we won't be.
In the way that Jesus doesn't necessarily play defense against sin, he plays offense against it by going to the cross, by taking active agency and laying down his life, not just trying to prevent people, just people in general from sinning. He's like, no, I'm going to go take this head on. Really, offense is the ultimate defense here.
I think in that moment, not to derail you totally, but like, yeah. Just the whole sense of like, hey, the enemy is even greater than you think they are. Like, they're even better, but like, we are going to do this. Like, we will skate with them. Like, that to me was sort of like the sanctification diagram of like, your sin is greater than you think it is, but God's grace is all the more. Like,
ooh,
does that make sense?
Yeah. Iconic diagram that we use a lot. So
sorry to cut in.
No, that's good stuff. Finally, he reminds his people of his true identity when he's like, you were born to be hockey players.
Tonight, we are the greatest hockey team. You were born to be hockey players. Every one of you. And you were meant to be here tonight. This is your time.
Absolutely iconic. But again, I think in that speech, he goes, you were born to be hockey players. He reminds people of their true identity. And the Lord does this in Isaiah 43:10. He says, "You are my witnesses," declares the Lord, "and my servant whom I have chosen, so that you may know me and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me no God was formed, nor will there be one after me." And so I think he does a great job of reminding the boys who they are, their true identity. And out of that, they perform unbelievably. The performance does not create identity. Identity creates performance. And so for all these reasons, that's why Herb wins my Jesus Award.
You were born to be hockey players, each and every one of you. Yeah, I think Herb, I have to say, Graham, I'm pretty surprised you pick Herb. I think of you, your Jesus Award selections are often like, yes, this is the main character. They get a lot of screen time. They do a few noble things. But like Charles Carroll, though. Or you'll pick like the Rashida Jones character in Social Network. Did you give it to her?
Yeah, I did.
So I'm kind of surprised you went with Herb here. But I guess he does really have that like vision to see the finish line. And he leads the players there. He's like the shepherd of the flock.
I just love the way in which he builds missional community. You know, I'm a sucker for missional community. And
yeah, and I loved your introductory point about how like each of these players was chosen for a specific reason. Like, I watch tape on all of these guys. I know them. Like, he has that kind of omniscience. Like,
sure.
You know, not that Jesus picks us because of what we bring to the table. Let's be clear. We don't bring anything to the table. But right. He does have that Herb, like, he knows, Jesus knows everything about us when he picks us.
Yeah.
And he does pick us, like you said.
Yeah, we're just monkeys humping a football.
It's interesting because in that scene, I wasn't going to even like take so much the he's calling them out of it as much as like the he lets them fight.
Hmm.
Like, I think Jesus a lot of times feels like this God that just lets the fighting happen.
Yeah. All right, Kev, take me to your Jesus Award.
I think Herb is the most memorable, and he feels like the character I walk away from this story with. And I think Micah Ruzioni is my favorite. I think assistant coach Patrick is an honorable mention, but I'm actually thinking that the most Christ-like might be Patty.
Oh, I knew it. I knew that's where you're going.
And so like Hermione with Harry, Patty is so patient with Herb. She tolerates his vain ambition and angry outbursts. She's tender and loyal and kind. She assumes his passion for hockey and winning this gold medal, and she does everything she can to help him get there. And people forget that she makes real choices. They agree to move.
What'd they say?
I got the job.
I got the job. How about that?
Oh, great. Huh? When do you start?
2 weeks.
2 weeks? They want you to start that soon?
Well, the games are in February, so...
Yeah, but it's June. Is there even ice?
Mommy!
Oh, you know, we're supposed to take the kids to the Black Hills.
They carpool those kids. Like, she has to sacrifice to make that happen because she originally would have needed Herb to do it, but Herb, you know, she lets him not give up his meeting.
Kelly has ballet at 4 tomorrow, and Danny's done with hockey camp at about the same time. Which one do you want to get? Her.
Yeah.
Can you pick up Danny at 4 o'clock?
Well, we got team meetings after practice tomorrow.
Well, I can't be in two places at one time.
Well, what about Margie? I thought she was
there on vacation.
I don't know, honey. You'll figure it out.
They sacrificed their trip to the Black Hills that they were going to take their kids there. It's like a throwaway line. But she's also hurt when Herb rejects and undervalues her. And I think that we forget that Jesus is like this. It's not that we can actually wound Jesus apart from the cross, but Jesus' heart aches when we go against him. He longs to be our loyal and cuddly confidant.
You'll still have everything you won here in Minnesota.
Don't tell me what I'll have, Patty. You don't know this enough to tell me then.
You know, I understand you being upset with me when I say you work too hard teaching a simple game. But don't ever criticize me for caring about you.
And so I've picked Joel 2:13 here. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love. I think that that fits Miss Patty to a T. And I hate that this is a podcast because the final moment of victory when Herb makes eye contact with her kind of through all these passing people. She's in the stands and they just have this like silent, like wordless moment. Just the eyes, the visual, the music, it sells everything. It's just the chef's kiss of writing and directing. And she's so, so happy for him when he wins. And we forget that when we win, Jesus wins. And like, he is so for us. I think we think he's the Herb Brooks disciplinarian blowing the whistle again, 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 send him. And maybe there are parts of God that are like that, but he's also like Patty. And ultimately, Herb is going to conclude, Patty had been right.
As I watched them out there celebrating on the ice, I realized that Patty had been right. It was a lot more than a hockey game.
not only for those who watched it, but for those who played in it. I've often been asked in the years since Lake Placid, what was the best moment for me? Well, it was here. The sight of 20 young men of such differing backgrounds, now standing as one. Young men willing to sacrifice so much of themselves, all for an unknown.
Patty, you are the way, the truth, and the life. Just kidding. You are my Jesus Award winner.
That's awesome. You know what came to mind? Strong shades of Charity from The Greatest Showman.
Absolutely. And just the whole things of like, my hubby is going for everything and I'll be by his side, but then he like goes too far. Thankfully, Herb didn't go off the rails like P.T. Barnum did, but yeah. I think that's a great parallel.
Yeah. Again, the character who's often underrated as being like, you're not really a part of this journey, but you're kind of this tangential character. But I agree. I mean, she's kind of the only person that Herb's willing to take anything from. Not the players, not his assistants. It feels like she's the only one who's really able to speak truth into his life in a challenging way.
And she's always asking him a thoughtful question about how it's going and, you know, what she can do to help. And what would it take for us to see Jesus as a true ally in the things that we really want? I think there are so many things about us that are broken where we want the wrong things. And Jesus has to step in and say, no, don't touch the hot stove. This isn't actually good for you.
Right.
That we forget that like he's this loving father who is relishing our victories and rooting for them and delighting in our spiritual growth. Mm. So that's it for the awards. And now on to our special guest. And this week we have Emma Vandeveld with us from Narrow Way to Broadway podcast. Emma, what's up?
Nothing much. So happy to be here. I'm so excited. I just mentioned to you guys before, I'm not used to being on this end of the mic, so I think this is going to be fun.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your podcast for one, and then two, just like what you're up to.
So Narrow Way to Broadway, like you said, is the podcast that honestly probably the best way to contextualize it for your listeners is to say that it's almost the same thing, but for theater, mostly theater. We have actually expanded a lot into like the film and TV realm, had some like directors, producers on as well. But we like to say it's the intersection of faith and theater arts, and discussing topics affecting the hearts, minds, and homes of artists everywhere is kind of our taglines. So I work full-time as a podcast content manager for Moody Bible Institute, which I started in late August. I went from like the acting audition grind to something more structured. So I'm also planning my wedding. I'm getting married in June. So that is crazy because that is a full-time job as well, at it feels like. And then also my fiance and I are looking to buy a house to move into after we get married. So that's kind of what's going on with me.
Graham and I both listened to the episode with your fiance and I really liked it. I also listened to the Allison Bailey interview, which is how I found you, because Graham and I went to see Wicked in Charlotte a few months ago.
Just a truly beautiful and incredible experience. We've done a couple musical films, but to be able to see it in person is just a whole other.
It really is amazing, for sure. I'm glad you guys got to see it. And I'm glad you got to see her too. She's, amazing and has been with the show for so long.
Yeah, absolute dynamite.
Yeah, she specifically blew me away as Glenda. And so I followed her on Instagram and then she shared the link to your podcast and now we're here.
Thanks, Allison.
So Emma, share with us one way that you've seen the gospel and something that you've watched lately.
Okay, guys. So I, for the first time, watched all of the Lord of the Rings movies. I'd never seen any of them. And I think it was just truly me trying not to be like the person who like geeks out over the Lord of the Rings, or the Christian who's like, you gotta watch the Lord of the Rings. But I am now totally regretting that. And I wish I would have watched them sooner. And I'll just stick with the first one. So I'll just stick with the Fellowship of the Ring. The thing that stuck out to me the most was that no one is exempt from the power of the ring. So like the Fellowship of the Ring, like with the men and the dwarves and the hobbits, like the only thing that really unites them is the power of sin over them, essentially.
The ring is altogether evil.
It is a gift. A gift to the foes of Mordor. Why not use this ring?
You cannot wield it. None of us can. The One Ring answers to Sauron alone. It has no other master.
Aragorn is right. We cannot use it.
You have only one choice. The ring must be destroyed.
And it reminds me of like Romans 3:23 when it says for all sin and fall short of the glory of God, or like in Isaiah when it says we all like sheep have gone astray, you know, each of us has turned our own way, but the Lord has caused the iniquity in all of us to fall on him. And I was just amazed at how brilliantly this was represented in the film. These characters, each of them are sort of like tempted by it. And we know that, you know, Frodo is the one who has to bear this journey, this mission. But there are a few times when other characters get close to touching it or having it, or we even see like Boromir is like, we can use this, we can do this. But then, you know, that ultimately leads to like something horrible. So I think that that's probably what I would say stuck out to me the most in terms of biblical themes in just the first movie of the Lord of the Rings.
I've actually not seen Lord of the Rings. I know Kevin and I, we tried to watch one of the movies when we lived together back in college, but I think I'm waiting for the perfect moment, but sure. I do like what you say in that sin is the great equalizer, right? Mm-hmm. Like if there's nothing we can do to wrestle on our own with that kind of depravity. So
yeah, like it talks about in 1 Peter 5, it talks about being alert and of sober mind. It says that your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. Like that's super intense imagery. This ring has so much power over these guys. And even in the second movie, we meet this character named Gollum, who's like the like creature looking guy, and we hear his story. And there's this constant back and forth where he like doesn't want to be overcome by it, but then he is. And it's like in Romans 7, it says, I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that is, in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it is no longer I who do it, but it is the sin living in me that does it. Which, golly gee, like I was just thinking of that the whole time I was watching this movie, because you see these characters like struggling. So there are two instances in the first movie where the characters that are sort of seen as the righteous characters like resist the ring. Like it's not that they think they're above it or that they can't fall prey to its power. It's that they're actually so aware that they can fall prey to its power that they're alert and sober-minded enough to say like, no, I won't take it, which I think is really interesting because it's put up against this character named Boromir who wants to like use the power of the ring and thinks that he can be close to the power of the ring without falling prey to it.
Yeah, I love that. I have a few thoughts. The ring is actually so effective over Frodo that a lot of fans have had trouble empathizing with him and rooting for him as a character. I think it's C.S. Lewis. I think it's The Great Divorce where like there's a character who has like a lizard on his shoulder. And the angel's like, do you want me to destroy it for you? It's like, it's wounding you. And he's like, no, I can like kind of keep it here. Like, I'm kind of familiar with it at this point. Like, it grows a little bit and it's painful, but I've come used to it. Or maybe you're thinking of like Eustace in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, where like he's become this dragon and it's like, it's going to be really painful to like rip those scales open. But like, we need someone external who can come in and do it. And I think just as Boromir kind of thinks that he can handle the ring, like we can wield it or like we can like... Yes, it has like great capacity for evil, but like we're good enough to kind of steer the ship. I think we kind of think we can do that with sin. Like we think it's like a little fire in the fireplace and we can kind of warm our hands by it when we want to, but it's actually going to like rip this mansion and burn it down. And we're standing there with like a squirt gun and like we don't have a chance.
You're so right. I think that the high view of our own sin, I think that that's the only thing with, you know, Gandalf and with Aragorn, when they're offered the ring, that's the only thing that can actually prevent them from taking it, because they know like, actually, I'm not strong enough to have this in my hand. Like I actually have to stay away from it. So I think you're absolutely right in that. And it reminds you of the quote that Bilbo says, that's like, it's a dangerous business, Frodo, going out of your door. You step into the road and if you don't keep your feet, there's no telling where you might be swept off to. We need to be aware of where we're planting our feet. And in order to do that, we need to acknowledge, like, I am capable of sin. I am so capable of everything that people in this movie were capable of. So, yeah,
Emma, you did an awesome job. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Sadly, we have to stop the discussion there, but before we close, here's a quick shout out to all of our supporters on Patreon who make this discussion possible. Samantha Armas, Kelly Barkley, Courtney Kristen Craig and Heather Carlock, Tanner Carlson, Gabe Doherty, Jacob DeRizio, Ben Dunbar, Thomas Eldridge, Rebecca Entwistle, William Harwood, Graham Janet and Ken Hooten, Taylor Huffman, Hunter Keyes, Maggie King, Daniel Lee, Bess McLaughlin, John Papone, Scott Pahacik, Logan Russell, Andy Simmons, Will Smith, Kim Streamer, Helen Webster, Clay Young. Thank you so much for your support. Information about the podcast can be found on our Instagram at Jesus and Movies. But for $1 a month, you can get our weekly update, a vote towards movie picks, shout outs on the podcast, features on the Instagram, and an invite for you and a plus one to the Jimmys on April 23rd in Charlotte by becoming a patron at patreon.com/JesusandMovies or on the free Patreon app. Please write us at JesusandMovies@gmail.com. And lastly, if you're listening on Apple, leave us a review and let us know what you think. That helps us to learn more about what's working, what isn't, as well as reach new people. Thank you so much for joining us on the Jesus and Movies podcast, and we hope you found some goodness, truth, and beauty. Know that God does have a plan for our pain, just like he did for Jesus, who died so that uncommon men could be on a missional team built on the miracle of his atonement and resurrection. And we'll see you next month.